It's all about just steady, low double-digit returns with no losses along the way. That's our biggest focus so that they can compound wealth long-term with capital preservation always at the forefront.
Welcome to the Passive Income Brothers podcast.
Here, we take the fear out of real estate investing using real-life stories of everyday successful investors.
Let's go.
Welcome to another episode of the Passive Income Brothers podcast. My name is Tim Lyons, and today I'm joined by my brother and co-host, Greg Lyons. How are you doing today, Greg?
Tim, I'm doing fantastic. Another great day for a Passive Income Brothers podcast. And we have a wonderful guest today, Dylan Marma, who's done some pretty exciting things in the real estate world. And a little different. He's kind of outside the multifamily realm a little bit. So really, really interested to hear his journey in real estate.
No doubt. So, you know, obviously we're called the Passive Income Brothers, and there's not just one way to create multiple streams of passive income. And although we kind of focus a little bit on, you know, how we kind of got here with the single family type stuff and obviously multifamily, which we're obviously bullish on, but there's a lot of ways to do it. And I think Dylan's going to bring a great, he's going to bring another way to do it. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Dylan Marma. How are you doing today, bud?
I'm doing good. Thanks, Tim and Greg, for having me on the show.
Yeah, man, we've been trying to get Dylan pinned down for some time, but we finally did it, which is great. So, Dylan, why don't you take the listeners through kind of, you know, where you've been, what you're working on, and kind of where you're going.
Yeah, so I actually got my start in multifamily real estate. I guess even before that, I started off with buying a single family rental property through a turnkey investment company, and then bought a duplex while I was working in W-2, their turnkey investment company. Went in not knowing what I was doing, probably paid too much for those properties, but collected some cash flow and made out okay in that experience. But as I began to really study real estate, I quickly learned that I thought multifamily real estate had one of the best potentials for returns. And I think that I learned that as you get into larger properties, you can have more effective management by being able to afford on-site staff and things along those lines. I'm sure a lot of the concepts you guys teach on the show. And as I learned about the model of multifamily and then multifamily syndication, I really sunk my teeth in and spent every waking moment of free time I had learning everything I possibly could about the model and how it worked, because I was just fascinated by it. I thought it really gave me the sort of intellectual stimulation that I wanted and also a lot of the freedom that I wanted in life. So I started to pursue that, and I began to just pursue the business, began to build my network, and then eventually linked up with some partners that had existing experience and had grew an existing portfolio. And then I came in as sort of the young sweat equity to be able to add sort of fuel to the fire by being able to put in systems in place to be able to bring in outside capital and begin to scale what we did. So I had a great run for 3 years with the group Rand out of Tennessee, and we did probably 750 doors or so of multifamily in Tennessee and Kentucky. And we were vertically integrated, so we managed everything that we did. So that's where I got my start. And then just before COVID hit, we partners and I decided to go in different directions, started a new company under the Requity Group, or TRG. And at that time, living in Knoxville, Tennessee, I had met Tim Clayton. I had met a lot of folks that had done extremely well in the mobile home park space, and multifamily cap rates were, you know, significantly compressed versus where they were when I started. And I saw where the cap rates were in the MH space at that time. And I saw a lot of, you know, fragmentation and true mom and pop opportunities. So I just dug right in, and fast forward, you know, 18 months later, roughly, we have 1400 units of mobile home and RV campground sites throughout North Carolina, Tennessee, Florida, mainly the Southeast. And we've built a vertically integrated platform where we have 30 plus employees, and you know, we've been very, very active. So it's been a great run thus far.
Dylan, wow. You know, when you think about it, you've touched nearly every part of real
Holy
estate,
Christmas,
right? but kind of starting in the turnkey model, where, you know, that is for people to, you know, link up with a company who does the acquisition, they renovate a property and give it to you with a tenant already in place. That's kind of the turnkey model. And that's really great kind of to get started. Then into multifamily syndication. But what's really interesting and something that our listeners haven't heard too much about is the mobile home park and the RV campground. And, you know, you said that, you know, you saw an opportunity there, more mom and pop operators and stuff like that. Kind of walk us through the mobile home park and RV angle of real estate, because you're the first one we've had on our podcast.
Sure.
And something really interesting, for people to explore.
Sure. So I'll start with just focusing on traditional manufactured housing, mobile home parks, as I think that, you know, that's where I started in this space, and then one sort of led into the next. But with the mobile home base, I think a lot of people from the outside view them as risky because you think it's probably a lower income demographic. And there's, you know, of course, the trailer park stigma, you know, lingers around for a lot of people based on, you know, where in the country you grew up and kind of what, how you viewed those. And when I started to really dig in and understand the model, then I had that light bulb moment where I realized that these actually have phenomenal fundamentals when it comes to the risk-adjusted returns the MH space can produce. The big light bulb moment for me was when I realized that the average resident stays for 15 to 20 years, whereas traditional multifamily is usually around a 2-year period, maybe 2 to 3 years. So you have a longer term tenant base. And then even more than that is, in many cases, almost all the time we go in and our objective is to sell off any homes that we own. So we went into some large park-owned home communities because I had the multifamily background. I was used to kind of assembling the crew of maintenance guys to do the turns and the rehabs. But our end objective is always to be able to sell the homes off over time to create a pure resident-owned home community. So by the residents owning their homes, they now have skin in the game. A lot of times, even older homes are all selling 10K plus, right? Especially recently with inflation, everything's shot up. So they're investing a significant amount into each home to be able to own the home. And that's done via third-party mortgages or rent-to-own programs or cash sales. So now they have skin in the game. They own their home. They're going to treat it with the pride of ownership and take good care of it. And at this point, for us, it becomes just a pure land lease business. So at this point, we are responsible for, we do the grounds. I know some people have their residents mow their own lawn. We don't follow that model because we like a really clean looking product, but we do all the grounds. We do take care of the signage, take care of the amenities, enforce strict site standards with the residents to make sure they're taking good care of the community, kick out any bad egg residents to make sure it's a safe place to live, put in security cameras, put in additional lighting, right? But ultimately we are there to be able to run the community without having all of the constant turnover that we deal with, right? With traditional multifamily, there's constantly HVACs blowing and roofs to get replaced and floors that get turned and maintenance guys that are slacking on the job and your turns are taking too long. Whereas in this case, once you're at a pure resident-owned home community, it is one of the stickiest, most stable income streams with very minimal CapEx volatility affecting you along the way. So that model itself is fascinating. And then when I saw where the cap rates were, after factoring in that a lot of that reduces your risk along the way because you're kind of taking your CapEx risk off the table in many ways. So when I saw that cap rates were 200 basis points over multifamily, now given this was, you know, 2 years ago, roughly, I said, it doesn't make any sense. So we went in and started buying a ton of them. And over the last 2 years, we've seen the cap rates compress to where they're almost even now. So it is getting tougher to be able to find the opportunities that were available when we really went on, you know, our bigger, you know, buying spree. But at the same time, we're still, for us, that just means that we have to put in more legwork with doing even more cold calling and trying to do more direct to owner sourcing. Actually, every mobile home park we've bought has been off market, but I think we were just seeing maybe a higher volume. And now we're just getting more and more active with, you know, our cold calling efforts and things along those lines to just build up the pipeline to find opportunities that we can you still be able to get our target returns from in today's market. So That's mobile home parks. I don't know if we want to dive into that a little bit before we touch on.
No, I definitely want to do that. I mean, that's so I'm guilty, right? I'm going to raise my hand right now. If you're watching on YouTube, right? I'm guilty of having that massive limiting belief about mobile home parks and, you know, RV campgrounds. You know, that's just me. I'm going to admit it, right? I'm from New York City. And, you know, if I ever drove past a mobile home park, it probably looked like to me it was in disrepair and, you know, for better or worse, I had my own, you know, limiting beliefs about who lived there. And so when I started getting into the real estate space and hearing about multifamily and turnkey rentals, and then I'd hear something about self-storage and then something about mobile home parks. I'm like, mobile home parks? Who the heck would ever invest in mobile home parks? And it was my ignorance that I didn't know about it, right? But I think what you mentioned something about, you know, you got into turnkey rentals and, you know, because it sounds like you kind of just jumped in and then you got more educated about the real estate space and really understanding the fundamentals and how to buy and how to create cash flow and, you know, what the different sectors were. So, you know, a lot of people on this show may not know what a cap rate is, but I mean, essentially when a capitalization rate or a cap rate is nothing more than if you buy property with cash, what you can expect your cash on cash return to be. But obviously we use leverage in real estate. So, I mean, that's a whole nother episode probably, but as cap rates go down or they get compressed, the valuations of the property or the price at a property in nominal terms is higher or a lot higher in some cases. So you want to buy at a high cap rate, right? And exit at a lower cap rate. But anyway, so mobile home parks, the more I dove in and started looking at different pro formas and different areas of the country, there is a risk-adjusted return to mobile home parks. And by and large, they cash flow a little better right now than multifamily does. And, you know, there's chances for refinances. And then listening to people like yourself, Dylan, you know, it's a land lease play, right? So maybe you supply the pads, right? And people bring their homes or they, you know, construct their homes or they buy a home, a mobile home on that pad. And on that pad is electricity, right? And water and sewer. And there's some charges and some other income opportunities. But yeah, I mean, like, listen, like we're either in a recession right now, we're at the end of Q2 in June of 2022, and we're either in one or we're likely heading into one. And the resiliency, the conversations that we have all the time with investors are, you know, dude, like the market is so volatile, interest rates, oh my God, the sky is falling. Yet people need food, clothing, and a place to live, right? It's part of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And, you know, just because, you know, living in an urban area, I may not understand mobile home parks. There's a huge contingent of our country that needs an affordable place to live. So people like yourself who take up these parks and they make them better and they make them desirable. I mean, it really is. It's a mindset change. So can you talk to the people about like how you structure a deal maybe, or some of the deals you may have done?
Sure.
Like how can investors get involved with mobile home park investing and what should they look for?
Yeah. So I think like anything else, I think first starting with the sponsor themselves, understanding, you know, who it is that you're investing with and their track record in the MH space and understanding of the space is crucial. Then from there, I would have enough education to understand the basics on how the mobile home parks space looks. So you can ideally be able to look at their underwriting and get a general sense of does this resonate with me? Do I feel like this is a good business plan? One of our big things that we're passionate about is not doing rental increases to double someone's rent on them overnight on a manufactured housing place. Because a lot of times you have families that are on fixed income and you have, you know, again, you're dealing with, there's really not too many places down from there, right? And that's why it's so recession resilient, because when recessions happen, people oftentimes will downgrade, right? And this is usually, people like to think it's always an alternative to an apartment, but it's usually an alternative to a single family home. And in these cases, we don't want to go in and be the ones that, you know, bring rents from $250 a month to $500 a month overnight. We really try to take a, you know, very community conscious approach to being able to be thoughtful with our rental increases while still being able to provide the investor returns we need. But we've had to walk away from deals that we know we're not going to push the rents at the level that maybe our competitor will at times to be able to bring it up. So I think first, you know, I think that's important if that resonates with you to ensure that, you know, you understand the operator's overall, you know, view on their business plan and how it's being put into life. Then understanding the park-owned home piece is very different than the tenant-owned home piece. So understanding that you're going to have a much higher expense load on a park-owned home piece, and it's a higher, you have higher execution risk on that. So you definitely want to make sure that there's been experience with that. If there is a park-owned home component, another big play is infill plays where there's vacant lots that you're ordering new homes and infilling into the vacant lots. So you want to understand that there's supply chain issues and things that can delay that. So you want to make sure that business plan around the any kind of infill strategies that take place. And then once you have a basic idea of how the MH world works, then from there it's determining, you know, as an investor, what type of MH product type are you going to be investing into? Do you want to invest into a fund or a single deal? We started off with a single deal, then we launched a fund, and now we're on our third fund at this time, which is a blend of MH and RV. And occasionally we will do single deals because we'd have usually a max allocation towards any one deal. So we'll be able to open that up as an SPV for our investors. But I think you have to weigh always the pros and cons of the fund versus a single deal. The fund is great because you get diversification. I think some of the best deals out there, because of the nature of how a lot of mom and pops have not raised rents in 15 years, you might have really, really low cash flows in those early years. Whereas you might have some deals that are higher cash flow. So the fund kind of evens things out so you can get a nice blended return. You can be able to lower your risk across the board. So we really like the fund model because of that. Whereas the individual deal, you know, we try even with our funds to, we do video updates at the end of every quarter where we kind of explain what's going on, boots on the ground on site at each property. So we try to educate through giving them, you know, exposure to a lot of different deals. But an individual deal, you might have more information on the front end about that one deal because that's what the whole deck is marketed towards. And then you also might be able to just kind of follow along with that one particular deal. But I always say individual deals could have more alpha or upside if you get into the right one. But a fund is more of like a nice steady blend of deals to be able to reduce your risk. The biggest risks are generally, in my view, storm risk. The insurance products are not as great. So being in a place where you are subject to natural disasters, something you really want to make sure you're thoughtful and hedging against. And then two, you do deal with more private utilities in this versus, you know, traditional large multifamilies, all, you know, city water, city sewer. Here you can have septic tanks or wastewater treatment plants and things along those lines. We've gotten very comfortable with certain private utilities if we do the proper inspections up front, but there's always addition, you know, there's always risk that comes along with that. So just being able to understand, you know, the different risks in this space and how it all kind of ties together. And then, you know, for us, we just do a really simple, usually it's preferred return of around 7%. And then we do a 70-30 split. I'm a huge advocate for simple deal structures. And I'm also a huge advocate for holding long-term. We are not getting in this to go flip in 3 years. We really believe that these are going to continue to appreciate over time. There's one thing I didn't mention is a huge supply and demand disconnect. There's not a lot of new supply coming on markets, and a lot of counties are pushing back against that. So we really think that over time, these will become harder and harder to find. So we definitely take a very long-term approach. And I think for investors, I always say, you know, for us, if you're looking for steady Eddie kind of cash flow and you have a long-term outlook and you know, you like the idea of refinancing by the end of year five to pull out of your initial, you know, cash out and then hold long-term with us, that's who we're for. If you're looking for sort of a quick flip high, you know, if you're chasing a, you know, 20 plus IRR in 2 years or something like that, it's not that our deals aren't capable of doing that, because a lot of them would be able to do that, but we're not here to sell it in 24 months. We're here to add value, refi between years 3 and 5, really refi as fast as possible to return some capital and then hold it long-term. So
thank you for the kind of the crash course in mobile home park investing. It's phenomenal. And what I really wanted to ask you was, you know, like I was ready to throw my whole net worth behind this you know, because it sounds good. You know, it all makes sense, right? You know, like affordable housing, people, a lot of times people own their own manufactured home and you're collecting rent on the land lease. So pride and ownership, it's a great concept and it really does make sense. And you touched on it a little bit, like private utilities and stuff like that. But what are the kind of the downsides or the pitfalls that you have to watch out for? You do have a ton of experience in the mobile home park investing. So what are kind of the downsides or the evictions or evictions higher? What are some of those things to look out for?
Yeah. So there's a few things. And of course, I touched on the fact that right now, as pricing goes up, it's realizing that you may have residents, depending on the community in the area, right? You may have fixed income residents and things along those lines. If you're going into a community that's already resident-owned homes, that's why park-owned homes can be nice because it's more of a liquid resident base and you can kind of attract the right base as you sell the homes off. Yes, you deal with, you know, not the potential to have a lot of residents on fixed income and having to be thoughtful of, you know, catering towards that in your approach with your business plan. So I think that's an area where some operators will differ in their mentality and outlook. And that poses risk on the space, which could lead to possible rent control down the road or something along those lines if too many operators are getting too aggressive on that. Mm-hmm. And then, so there's always regulatory risk in the space because it is a demographic that, you know, the governments will be quick to step in and protect. Then you will have private utility risk. I think it's important to understand when it comes to water, it's almost exclusively just city water or well water. So you want to understand sort of how wells work. And for the most part, we haven't had too many concerns regarding wells, but you have risk of, you know, the water coming up with sulfur, you know, coming out brown or something like that. So you might have to go in and you definitely want to do a heavy inspection and make sure that you're prepared to be able to, you know, clean up any wells, put the proper filtration systems in as needed. And then on the sewer side, there's a couple of different options. There's septic tanks. The best, in our view, the best septic tanks are where you have a really high ratio or low ratio of number of homes versus tanks. So we like a lot of our communities have 1-to-1 home versus tank. So if one tank gets backed up, you don't have 15 people that are upset in the middle of the night calling you and you don't know who's the culprit of who's clogging it up, right? So we like to have, you know, one tank per home or two tanks per home, even three tanks per home is not bad, but we don't like to have one giant tank for 20 plus homes, right? Something along those lines. So understanding septic tanks, I think, is important in mitigating your risk, making sure you have the proper replacement area. If a septic tank does fail, you want to have extra land on the property to be able to replace it and move the leach field. Then you have wastewater treatment plants, which are a miniature version of what a lot of municipalities have to be able to treat, you know, wastewater in a traditional sewer system. So these are a little bit more complex. And in the event where one of them breaks completely, this can be a multiple six figure. So it's definitely really, really important to get professional eyes on those treatment plants and understanding the risk inside and out, having, you know, the ample sort of reserves on the sideline, just and factoring that into your price, right? I think, you can make them work. We have done one of them, but we're always very cautious on those. We've walked away from deals because of bad septic tanks. We've walked away from deals because of treatment plants. But again, it's a very situational thing and you have to factor that into the overall risk and deal. And then you also have lagoons, which we generally stay away from completely, which are, I don't understand. And I'm definitely not acting like the expert here on this. I definitely, you know, lean on our team and vendors. But lagoons are almost, you know, they'll look like almost like a pond that's got like a seal over it that, you know, the runoff goes into. So those also can be high risk and just something we generally stay away from. But those are the big ones. So understanding the basics on that, because I knew none of that before I got into this space. So really understanding the basics on how all of that works is important. And then, as I mentioned, I think the evictions, as I mentioned, natural disasters are definitely just something to be cautious of and make sure you have ample reserves for if you're on the coast. We have quite a few coastal properties, but we also pay crazy amounts of insurance to hedge against that. And we also keep extra capital on the sidelines on those properties, just in the event anything does happen, we have some extra cash to be able to pull in and fix things up as needed, because the residents might not have enough money to, you know, sitting on the sidelines to fix up their own home in the event that, you know, something comes up. And then to your point about evictions, most of our portfolio is North Carolina, Tennessee, and Florida. And to be honest, we have three regionals, a COO. So I'm not as involved with the day-to-day. So they could probably do a way better job than me in terms of being able to break down the specifics on the eviction process by state. But the evictions can be cumbersome at times. And in the event where you have to, it's generally harder to evict someone that at the point they own the home. So a lot of the times we try, if they're low on cash and they can't afford their payment or something along those lines, we try to buy their home off them to be able to resell it before, rather than evicting them. So that's always preferred as a sort of cash for keys scenario. And we're happy to pay them a fair price. It's really not about making a profit. It's about just getting someone else in there that's going to be a better fit resident for the home. But the eviction process, in the event that you do run into those, or you have abandoned homes occasionally, those can definitely be sort of a thorn in your side, and sometimes take several months to get them back on market. So overall, the default rate, you got to put in perspective, you know, they're paying $400 a month or so for lot rent. So it is, you know, usually less than 50% of what an apartment costs. So it is a little bit easier to come up with that amount of money. So you don't have as much of like the ongoing collection issues. It's fairly comparable to C-class apartments when it comes to the collections, I would say, and sometimes better in quality communities.
So what I'm hearing, Greg, and I think you aptly named this the masterclass crash course in mobile home park investing. And this is what I kind of needed, because I kind of knew a little bit about this, but definitely not to this extent. But this is why you have to find the operators that are the experts in this space, whether it's turnkey or mobile homes or apartments or industrial or self-storage. You know, it's qualifying the operator or the sponsor or the general partnership team. It's qualifying the market. It's getting into the data, right? Because mobile home parks might sound great, and I want to put my money to work, but you have to know that you're working and building a team and surrounding yourself with the folks that know, just like Dylan knows, right? So I love that, Dylan. So thank you for that background. So who is your ideal investor? You know, because I got to be honest, like being from right outside New York City, like I had a hard enough time, you know, crushing limiting beliefs and, you know, growing out of my scarcity mentality to getting into real estate, right? Because real estate investing, you know, whether you're active or passive, there could be a high bar to entry, even if you have the capital on the sidelines. You know, just wrapping your head around, you know, ceding the control over to a sponsor or something like that. So who is your ideal investor? And what are some of the questions that maybe you and your team kind of have with investors that want to join you?
Yeah. So I think the ideal investor is one that aligns with the expectations we set. We're huge into putting a lot of thought into the expectations we set for investors. And we are always conscious of doing our absolute best never to overpromise or oversell what it is that we do. The ideal investor is one that shares a similar long-term outlook that we share. A lot of our investors that sort of meet our kind of avatar investor are looking to build up a stream of cash flow, or they're already working on building up a stream of passive income that they can use to likely eventually replace their current income as they prepare for retirement and things along those lines, or just having a safety net, and they don't believe in more of the old school nest egg retirement, right? Where it's save up enough to be able to burn through it, you know, before I die. It's more of just building a, you know, steady stream of passive income that they can count on. A lot of the times they want diversification. They may not be opposed to the stock market. They may still be investing in the stock market, but they might see that, you know, having exposure to real estate, especially right now with the inflation and things along those lines, is beneficial. But I would say that, you know, it's someone that is interested in targeting just steady Eddie you know, returns. We try to say we're not swinging for the fences, taking high risk on every deal. We're trying to hit a lot of consistent doubles and never lose money. So it's all about just steady, low double digit returns with no losses along the way. That's our biggest focus, so that they can compound wealth long term with capital preservation always at the forefront.
Yeah, you know, capital preservation isn't the worst thing, you know, in volatile times or in good times, really. You know, you want to make sure your money's safe while still working for you. And that's fantastic. You know, I wanted to switch gears just a touch because you are in the RV campground business as well. And again, this is going to be kind of a new concept to our listeners and to myself. And as I think about the RV campground business, I don't think of it as a need. I think of it more as a luxury or more like a short-term rental. I'm not sure if that's a good comparison, but can you walk us through kind of the economics and the thoughts around investing in RV campgrounds?
Right. Yeah. So first of all, it's important to clarify that there are three different types of RV campgrounds. Our first exposure to the RV campground space was a mobile home park that had an RV campground attached to it, and it was 50-50. And the RV campground side functioned almost identical to the way the mobile home park side did. They were all there super long-term. They lived in their RVs. And a lot of times when you see those blended communities, that's usually what it is. It's more of a lot of times they function more like a mobile home community than RV. But that was our first exposure. And then our second exposure, our first full-on RV campground was one that was in an area where we already had several hundred sites along the coast of North Carolina. It was on the intercoastal. It had a great, small little bunch of wet slips, like a small little marina, some dry boat storage, and everyone there was there for many, many years. And they had, they would pay for the year, many of them even paying for the year up front, some of them paying quarterly. And they did not live there, though. They lived within a 2-hour drive radius, and they would come here with the family on the weekends and fish and hike and hunt and get together and, throw events and things along those lines. And when we found that, we were just fascinated with the model because it really checked a lot of the boxes that we were looking for with the MH space. And we had some great sales comparables, so we felt comfortable enough to step in and begin to explore the model. And then we shortly after hired someone that had background with EOS and Sun Communities, that had kind of the long track record with RV campgrounds and how to manage the community. So we brought him on, started learning everything we could about the space. And the bigger difference is there is more of a hospitality component, even if they're long term. So we have events going on nonstop. I mean, multiple events a weekend in some cases, just to make this the best experience and weekend getaway for these people that have long-term leases with us. Because we want this to be a place that they can share for generations and pass down to their families. So that was our next exposure, and then we had another one that was similar to that in Gatlinburg in Tennessee. So we have two now that are in the Smoky Mountains areas, and that's the number one outdoor destination in the country by quite a bit. And we felt like that was a really strong place that, with the natural amenities would never see demand die off. So we felt comfortable going into there. And then after getting enough exposure and throwing, events in the long with some of the long-term campgrounds, we also have gotten into two that are more peer, were at least at the time more peer play short term. There's a little bit of a long term component on those two. We'll say they're hybrid, but they have more of the short term aspect to them. So we have one campground that's getting 100 bookings per week. It's extremely active, and it really comes down to having a rock star manager. If you don't have that, then again, it's going to be challenging. So you really have to hire right, get the right manager, the right butts in the right seats to be able to execute. Your payroll costs are usually higher on RV campgrounds in general because you have more people there just focused on helping with the events and keeping people engaged and having a great time. So you definitely have payroll that on a per site basis are probably closer to what your multifamily payroll looks like. You don't have as much maintenance heavy, but it's more kind of front desk and part-time work. You have what you call work campers too, which I absolutely love. These are people that travel the entire country and they work for free site rent oftentimes, or just for an hourly rate, but it's usually part-time work and they're happy to contribute sometimes purely just because they love the campground, they want to do something rather than sit around all day. So you have that going for you. But yeah, it's still a land lease business, which is one of the reasons we love it, because you have the land lease aspect to it. The hospitality piece, I think the short-term piece can provide really high yields. Generally on short-term campgrounds, we typically would target, if it was pure short-term, somewhere in the, you know, the low to mid teens cash on cash returns, which is extremely hard to find in today's day and age. So you have a return worthy of maybe the additional risk that you might see from having more short-term leases and volatility there. Now, in terms of where we see things going right now, with gas prices going up and things along those lines, that's, I think, the big question. Now, I don't know if you guys have traveled recently, but, you know, airlines are also multiplying, you know, the prices for traveling. So it's not just RVers that are getting hit on travel. If you want to look at the alternative travel, which is usually your traditional sort of plane, then hotel getaway, that's also going up, you know, substantially as well. We have seen a handful of cancellations at our short-term communities due to the gas prices going up, but it hasn't been enough to make a material impact. But either way, for us, we generally like the long-term RV residents, and we're huge on location here. We're not in the build, if you build it, they will come, and buying in the middle of nowhere and building the next Disneyland RV resort, just because we think that's risky. And if things dry up and if people don't have as much discretionary cash, then, you know, you're going to have a tough time. We like to have the optionality to be able to have it serve as both a temporary and affordable living situation in addition to destination location, sort of where, but in a good, strong 200K plus MSA that's growing and has good fundamentals to it. So that, you know, in a doomsday scenario, you can always kind of backpedal. Like, a lot of times we don't let them live there full time, but we want to be in areas where if we opened it up to that, we'd be flooded with applicants and things along those lines. So in terms of the space itself, there's a lot of reports out there saying it's got a 6 or 7%, you know, compounded annual growth rate projections for the space. 9% of households in the entire country have RVs. There was over 600,000 RVs sold last year alone. And there's a, last I checked, there was a $14 billion backlog on Thor Motor Industries, which is the number one manufacturer and seller of these throughout the country. So COVID really accelerated this whole thing, but it's a trend that's been going on for a few decades now. And you have a ton of people that are now interested in either living in RVs or, you know, working in RVs or just using them for leisurely activities, reconnecting with the outdoors, using Wi-Fi and work from home rules and things on those lines to be able to take advantage of it. So it's got a lot of good, great things going for it in that sense.
Well, I'm ready to sign up. So how about you, Greg?
No, it's great. It's fantastic to learn about these things. This is what we're here for.
Yeah. You know, and I think, like, you know, being in the space that we're in, we're mostly multifamily. We do some self-storage, and now we're going to start doing some industrial stuff too. You know, this is something that, you know, I've been meaning to kind of dive into for a while. So I'm super excited to kind of get into this, and I definitely want to learn more. So definitely put me down on your email list, Dylan, sure. before we forget about that, because I want to definitely learn more. But yeah, I mean, look, I mean, we always, when we think about investing in real estate, we want the granite countertops, the nice backsplashes, the sexy pools, the class A built, you know, properties. And, like, you know, that's the only thing we can focus on. Yet, you know, all across America, there's different strata of folks that are living and playing in a different part of the country and with different rules and different economics. And this is what it's there for, right? But there's, you know, obviously tremendous opportunity in that space. With that said, Dylan, I want to be mindful of our time here today. So I wanted to transition into the last three questions we ask all of our guests. And the first one is from a mentor of ours, Robert Kiyosaki. You may have heard of him before. And he says something that's kind of telling in these economic times, but it can be a big turnoff to people that don't understand what he's talking about. And he says that savers are losers and debtors are winners. So what is, if you heard that and somebody said, Dylan, what does that mean to you, bro? What would you say?
Well, I would say that right now is a good time to have cash. So if the savers have been saving, this is a good time to start getting ready to look around and deploy more than ever right now. We think we're kind of probably fighting the same battle you guys are, where we're just waiting on sellers to start to adjust their expectations. And we're kind of at a little bit of a standstill during this moment, but that could change any week or any month now. So we're huge believers that right now is a good time to have liquidity, because I think the next, 6 to 12 months will probably open the floodgates for some of the best opportunities that we have. So it's okay if you've been a saver, but definitely this is the time to begin to, look at that. And then of course on the debt side, this is really the debt is one of the biggest drivers of real estate investing as a whole, and it moves prices more than anything else. So when we look at, possible inflation projections of 8 or 9% or whatever, the forecasts are today, and your debt is still, 5% in today's world, you have a pretty good spread there. So as long as we believe that real estate can keep absorbing that, you got a good spread just on your debt versus inflation. I think Sam Zell has some good quote about, how most of his money in real estate was just made with the arbitrage between inflation and debt rates.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you make a fantastic point about, this podcast is going to come out in the summer of 2022, and we're most likely going to be in a recession, officially in a recession. Right. The news is going to be bad, but I think those are the times when the buying opportunities will present themselves to make real gains in your portfolio. So, with that being said, you hear people say that investing in real estate is too risky. And what would you say to someone that says that, especially in these kind of choppy times that we're in?
Well, if I invest anything in the stock market, the only thing I'll touch is Vanguard index funds usually, right? So I'm kind of one of those, the automatic deposit going on and solid dollar cost average throughout, the index fund, because I believe that long term, American business is going to continue to go up for the foreseeable future, for probably our lifetimes. And when it comes to real estate, I look at it fairly similarly, in a sense of, you have to buy. We're always buyers in any market cycle. Of course, we want to take advantage if there's, more material discounts. We're going to look at that, but we sort of know what the basics of what we're looking for in terms of our yield and our total projection. We're always going to be looking. And I think that as an investor, it's not in your best interest to sort of to time the market, but rather to be investing throughout the market and understanding that this is a boring business, really, right? It's just basic, fundamentals of, do you have enough cash to pay your debt? Does your debt have a long enough timeline to make sure that you can ride out if the debt markets ever dry up at all? Do you have enough reserves? So if a rainy day comes and COVID hits again and people, you go into the chaotic situations like that, do you have enough rainy day reserves to be able to fund the maybe any short-term losses during that time period? And as long as you have the fundamentals are in place, then, you're not going to become a forced seller, which means you're not going to lose money, as long as you believe that, people are going to be living, especially with what we do. It's all a lot of, affordable living, right? As long as you believe people are going to need housing and over the long term, then it generally should go up over time, whether it goes up in the next 2 years or not. Hard to say. If it goes down, we're not losing sleep over it, because we know we got the right debt in place, good fundamentals to keep cash flowing until things look better on the other side. So I think people oftentimes just don't know what they're looking at. As none of us knew what it looked like until we really started to dig in. But I think once you start digging in, educating yourself, real estate is one of the places you really can have capital preservation be a real thing. It's one of the only businesses that you can really feel that kind of confidence in.
Dude, I love that. I mean, you basically just touched on, Joe Perlis has a book, the best real estate investing advice ever, right? And he has something that he calls the three immutable laws of real estate. And it was buy cash flowing assets, You know, the second one was, you know, get, you know, fixed rate, long-term debt, right? And the other one is follow the data. You know, you need fundamentals, you know, population growth, job growth, you know, all that stuff. So if you follow those, you can sleep very, very well at night, you know, whereas I don't know, I'm sleeping well at night if I'm heavy into equities, but that's just me.
Yep.
Let me go into the third question here. It is it's from Jim Rohn, another one of our, you know, de facto mentors. And Jim says, a formal education will make you a living and a self-education will make you a fortune. So Dylan, what does that mean to you, bud?
Well, first off, Jim Rohn, I probably spent, hundreds of hours listening to him early on when I was getting into business and real estate. So huge fan of his stuff out there. I think it's great for personal growth. And I think when it comes to self-education, that's really been everything for me. I left school after 2 years and I was going to, you know, SUNY Albany in upstate New York, and really just kind of caught the bug to go pursue entrepreneurship and real estate investing. And, you know, one thing kind of led to the next, but the entire time I was always reading and always educating myself, and, you know, really took more of like the bootstrapped route and self-educated route to be able to kind of get into this stuff. So I think that, you know, no matter where you are in your career, you should always be diving into the books and educating, both from, you know, the book standpoint and also just, you know, your experience that life brings you along the way. So.
Yeah, dude, I love that. And listen, I think there's a stat out there that once you graduate college, adults in the United States read on average one book a year. And that used to be me, right? Before I got into this kind of space and shed my scarcity mentality, got into the abundance mentality and really kind of became defiantly committed to learning. And I think it's no wonder that Greg and I are where we are today because of that, right? So Dylan, thank you so much for your time today. It was really a pleasure having you on the show. It was a masterclass on mobile home park and RV park investing. This is going to be great. I can't wait to share this with our listeners. Once they hear this, how can they get a hold of you or find out more about you and what you're doing in your company?
Sure. Yeah. You can always get a hold of me. You can check out our website, therequitygroup.com. I'm active on LinkedIn and more recently getting active on Twitter as well. Found a lot of great minds on there as well. So definitely, you know, feel free to plug in with our newsletter, plug in with social media and kind of follow along with everything we got going on.
Awesome. Love that. So until next time, thank you for spending another week with us, and we will see you again next week.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Passive Income Brothers podcast. We would be grateful for your support of our podcast by giving our show a 5-star rating and review and subscribing to our show on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to take inspired action after listening to this show, so that you can start building out your passive income streams. Finally, head on over to citysidecap.com to connect with us and find out more information about how to get started passively investing in real estate.